I just think this comment doesn't fall under our purview.
Yeah.
It's really about measure development.
I agree.
Yep.
I agree as well.
Yep.
Okay. Line 33.
Ditto. I think the issue of the specification of measures is an important issue, but it's not really a feasibility issue.
Yeah, and we actually do address a little bit of that. You know, assessment of measure logic, we did include how complex is the logic and how easy is it to explain to providers is, you know, part of that kind of initial feasibility, which would address some of these issues.
Mike, do you know where that is, where we say that?
It's on page 12 of the document under assessment of the measure logic, towards the end of recommendation 2.
Do you recall why we put that in?
Well, I think we wanted to get, so it's prefaced by, in addition to the scores for the individual data elements, the eMeasure feasibility assessment report should include, and then it has assessment of the feasibility of the aggregate data elements and some sub-bullets there, and then assessment of the measure logic. So I think what we were trying to say is that, you know, assessment of each individual data element is not sufficient to assess the feasibility of the overall measure, that there are other aspects to it.
Well, I do think it's important to look at as feasibility in context of the measure, and it's also important to say whether the measure as constructed will collect the data that is intended to be collected for the purposes of the measure. I'm not sure if really complexity of the logic or how easy it is explained to providers is really something that's should be part of the e-measure feasibility process. Looking at it again, wondering if anyone has us.
Yeah, and Howard, I actually agree, because if you think about it, and this is something that we had discussed before, you know, what is the complexity of the logic? Is it that we have 7 pages of ands and ors, that's burdensome? Should that be counted under feasibility? And then the other aspect of it, how easy is it to explain the logic to providers? Because it may be really easy to explain the intent of the measure to a provider, and they may want to understand every single aspect of the logic, but the logic is driven by constructs that sometimes are beyond the scope of what a provider is very familiar with, such as QDM constructs and HL7 timing relationships and all of that. And so part of the challenge with representing appropriate logic, sometimes it does increase complexity in order to accommodate for different representations of data in EHRs, for instance, different ways data can be recorded in EHRs. And it does make the logic more complex, but will it make the measure more infeasible? It may actually make it more feasible because it may fit more workflows, for instance.
Are you suggesting we remove those items from that reference on page 12?
I think it's very important to address what you've just said, the data elements in the context of the measure, and so pieces of the logic may be important to assess. I would say that it's probably beyond the scope of what we're trying to do with feasibility to address how many pages the logic has, how many data elements does the logic address. If they're all feasible, does it really matter?
Yeah, I have to agree with that.
Are there other points in the measure development process fairly early on where these are addressed? So I think that kind of the complexity of the ability to explain it to providers is getting at an important issue, that once you implement a measure, if it's so complex and kind of and the logic is so convoluted that it's tough to and you can't explain it to a provider, then you do run into the issues where they don't want to use it and they have trouble accepting it. I mean, they don't like the idea of the black box.
This is Ruth again. I guess my challenge with that is that it gets into EHR constructs, QDM data types. Is it really reasonable that all providers are going to have to understand all the aspects of every single piece of logic in order to accept the measure? And where is the trade-off? Do we make a measure less exact in order for them to be able to understand it quickly? It may be understandable. It may not be easy to understand, but we have that same challenge with paper-based measures. Sometimes the logic is complex, and the number of layers are many. And so I guess the question is, does that make the measure less feasible in terms of data collection and data aggregation and calculation? It really doesn't. It may speak to other NQF endorsement criteria, such as importance, and so the measure may be perceived as less important if it's not very understandable, but I don't think it speaks to feasibility.
Anybody else? So, I mean, I think that the recommendation then would be to remove the complete section on page 12 about assessment of the measure logic. I mean, there's three bullets. There's a bullet point and three sub-bullets. Does anybody else feel strongly?
No, I do.
One way?
I do, Mike, think that we do want to say that it's that part of the feasibility assessment is assessing the elements in the context of which they're used in the measure. Not just as individual, not just as completely independent entities that are not being looked at as context, in context.
Okay.
So I do think that there should be a statement about assessing the data elements in the context of the measure logic. I think Hoot and my points are really about whether the assessment should also address the complexity of the logic or how easy it is to explain to the providers, because I think she explained well that those things really don't seem to fall under the umbrella of e-measure feasibility.
And I would completely concur. I do think it's very important to assess the data elements in the context of the logic. And just as an example, I think it may be using the same tool that we use. Let's say that we're doing our first pass on feasibility is looking at the capture of certain data elements. If the data elements aren't captured at all, do we go a different route or do we try and get a little bit more detail around that data element and do a feasibility check again once we have the logic around that particular data element? And then we can actually see if the feasibility issue is with the data element itself, so the QDM data element, or if it's the context in which it's being used in a measure that's the problem. And I think that's actually very valuable in terms of feasibility.
I agree completely with what Hoot just said. I think we talked about this quite a bit at our in-person meeting as well.
Okay, so it sounds like those of us spoken up have been in favor of removing the ones around logic and adding in a comment about context of the measure, of the data element within the measure. Anybody disagree? Okay, we'll move on then. So line number 34. First one, I think we've addressed. We say we're going to remove it.
The commenter says data collection burden traditionally refers to the burden on healthcare providers themselves in this report, it appears the burden on EHR developers is a factor in determining feasibility. It also says measure developers. I think that our intention is that the burden is referring to the providers. I'm not sure where the specific language, but I don't think it was meant to refer to burden on vendors or measure developers.
This is Huta. I actually think that part of the framework does speak a little bit to the burden on EHR developers if, for instance, there are no structured fields within an EHR to capture a particular data element. That will require effort not only on the provider's side, but in order to capture that data element in structured format, but also potentially on the EHR vendor's side. What I think that the commenter is confusing is our discussion around the burden of completing the feasibility assessment, which is actually a burden on the developer, as we discussed it in the report, versus what we're trying to measure with the assessment, which is the burden on the provider. So I think there may be some confusion here on the part of the commenter. I don't know how our language in the report may be causing this, but it seems to me that we may be using the word feasibility on the measure developer side as a feasibility of the process of assessing feasibility. So that's why it may be confusing.
This is Zahid. I think that's a different angle, but I think that even if you look at the providers and the burden on them, the question is in the context of feasibility, shouldn't it also include the potential for having to develop new elements and so forth if part of feasibility might address some of that? That clearly it is a provider burden at the end of the day for most data capture, if not all, but there is an element of the vendors in there to the extent that something is not feasible because no one has it built into their systems.
Yeah, and this commenter is specifically referring to the first overarching principle on page 7, where we have this sentence, EHR vendors indicate that all data elements could be ultimately integrated into an EHR. However, the questions are whether the importance of the measure results justifies the cost and time required for development and whether clinical workflow can efficiently capture the necessary data as a byproduct of the provision and documentation of patient care. Until agreement is reached that everyone must achieve the same level of interconnection maturity, feasibility will be variable across all HR implementations. So I think what they're getting at is it makes it sound like, they were addressing this issue of the importance of a measure justifies the cost and time required for development and whether clinical workflow can efficiently capture. So what is the purpose of having that statement in there?
So, Mike, this is Zahid again. I think from what you just read, I think it captures it accurately because it addresses the provider burden and it also addresses potentially the burden which, in aggregate would have to be taken into account if new elements would have to be implemented or incorporated within systems. So I'm happy with the statement that you read, which is in the report, because it does address both issues, which I think are equally important, or certainly the developer side is also important, but certainly I'd be interested in hearing what others have to say.
I think our language is okay. I do think that part of the assessment is assessing the burden on the provider, and the overall feasibility reflects somewhat the responsibility, what the vendor will have to do to make it to make it work.
So I think then what we are saying that mostly when we talk about burden of capture, we're talking about provider, and I don't know if we need to be more explicit about that or not. I mean, I'm happy with the way it is now.
This is I think so too. I think this may be some confusion around the use of the word feasibility, but if taken in concept and context, I think we're fine.
Okay. Okay, next comment, line 35. The measure specification calculation logic, although the measure specification calculation logic are important understanding to measure may not be present early on the measure development. So I'm not sure is that back to what we've gotten rid of or not? No. Yes.
Second. Doesn't it go back to the logic evaluation?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. I don't know exactly which second sentence. Oh, I see. That's the second sentence that the measure specifications and calculation logic. The measure, so it says the TEP emphasized that feasibility is not solely about the data elements. The measure specification and the calculation logic are important to understanding the intent of the measure, which can influence what data must be collected. The number of data elements, so I think that there, although the measure specification is important to understand the intent of the measures may not be present early on in measure development. So they want, I would assume then that's on page 11, on the first, it's actually the second sentence of 2.2 e-measure feasibility assessment.
I think this goes back to the idea of the criteria and the context of the data element in the logic, more
uh-huh.
than a full-blown set of specifications and calculation algorithms. So I think it speaks to that duality of where the logic is important to assess feasibility versus where it's not. And I believe that the commenter is speaking to the idea, well, we won't have full measure specifications when we test for feasibility. And I agree. But I think with the modifications that we've made to the bullets on the logic, and if we clarify that we are really intending to assess the feasibility of a data element within the context of a specific logic criterion, for instance, that will help clarify.
Okay. Anybody else, or can we move on? Let's move on to line 36 then. Fully supports feasibility scorecard approach. So that one is in agreement, so we can move on. Line 37. Oh, my. So I think the comment actually has two things as well. So it says no measure should be considered feasible unless all data elements in the related context are feasible. And I guess, you know, I would go back to our kind of overriding comment that we're not looking for a yes, no, feasible, not feasible. We're looking for level of feasibility. So that's where that would kind of address that part of the comment. The second part, measure feasibility regarding the ability of the logic to score the measure correctly is highly significant, but a different issue than data element feasibility. These statements seem to combine the two. So I think we've kind of gotten away from looking at logic. So I think we've kind of addressed that as well. Anybody else have a comment there?
I would also say that we have made the comment before, or some have made the comment, that a measure is only as feasible as its least feasible data element. But it's not quite true, because an exclusion data element is much less valuable than a primary data element, such as the data element which captures the treatment that is to be given. So we shouldn't be using, if we are, or we shouldn't be saying that statement, which is that a measure is only as feasible as its least feasible data element.
I would agree.
And this is Ruth. I agree too. And actually, it's something that we've been thinking about a lot in terms of if a criterion is included in a measure that covers a very specific set of hospitals. Let's say that only academic hospitals do this one procedure, that it is an exclusion for a measure, and it's not particularly feasible. Does the fact that the burden is on a particular set of providers that is small, and that for them this may be a very feasible data element, but for other providers it may not be. It's interesting to see how a data element, depending on how it's used in the measure and the extent of coverage that it has and significance in the overall rate for a particular provider, can influence or not the feasibility of the measure. So just because a criterion is there doesn't mean that the measure can't be implemented even though the particular criterion isn't very feasible. So I would agree with Howard's comment.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I'm not sure that we've put in a way of formally capturing that. So if you have an exclusion data element that we would say scores low on the feasibility across all implementations, yet is really only applicable to certain areas, and in those areas it's captured reliably, that actually you could include that data element, and it could be and overall the measure could be very feasible, yet it would still have that one low feasibility score.
Well, I would even go further than that and say, suppose you have an exclusion that's really only going to affect 2% of your population. You would expect it to only affect 2%. And suppose that element is completely infeasible everywhere. I still think that measure should be rated fairly high feasibility. And you know what? You'll have to either forget about the 2% and just record them as a measure failure, or work around it in some way.
Well, and what I would assume is that if you have a specific population that where your population is much more than 2%, that you would figure out a way to capture that data. If it's 50% of your patients and you want to make sure that they're excluded, it's going to be much more important and for you to figure that out.
Right.
Whereas everybody else might not need to.
Let me try to drill down on this and understand this better. In a sense, isn't the better approach to not have the exclusion for the 2% than to include it and then have everybody look for it? I'm not sure that – I think when we publish measure specs and we publish an exclusion criteria, then in a sense we're looking for people to all look for that exclusion. That's one way of interpreting it. Are you saying from a measure development point of view – you're looking at it a different way? In other words, people can pay attention to some exclusions if they choose to?
Well, this is Ruth. I wouldn't say that, but let's say that you're talking about a critical access hospital and you're 99% of the time the patient that comes in will not be on a clinical trial, and this is from an inpatient perspective. So from an outpatient perspective, I think it's more difficult, I would say. But in that hospital, you can either create a form where for every single patient, a clinician has to say whether they're a clinical trial or not. You can implement a workflow where you allow for a clinician to say if a patient is in a clinical trial only when they are, because there are different ways of forcing certain workflows. Or if that particular hospital knows that they are not going to get patients in clinical trials and they just don't want to capture it in a structured format, then they can assume that they will not be credited on that exclusion. But it provides the flexibility to the hospital, and I think it does. I mean, the measure specification do, and they do from a patient, from a paper perspective, you do have to answer every single data element. From an EHR perspective, some of these exclusions maybe catch all exclusions that are not applicable to a particular hospital. And I don't think there's a final answer on how this shall be implemented across all providers, but certainly there is a possibility that a hospital chooses, for instance, not to document reasons for not in a structured format, and they realize that this is a mechanism that would allow them to pass the measure in exceptional situations, but they're not willing to do the work, and so they agree with the rate. And then you have the converse situation, which a hospital wants very badly to reach that 100%, and that is only feasible if you do have the possibility of expressing these exceptional situations. I think there's certainly a balance between what you are representing in the measure, but I also think there's this belief that every single criterion that is in the measure specifications has to be explicitly documented for every case. But the measure really is looking for the information. Is it there? Is it not? If it's not there, then you're going to fail that particular criterion wherever it takes you. So there's no longer that requirement of you shall touch every single data element in order to produce a measure rate. You may have a lower rate that may or may not be accurate, but that will depend on how much your particular provider is willing to go to capture that information.
Did you say that on paper you are expected to touch every data element in a sense?
Yes, because in the paper-based data collection, the data elements are not necessarily derivable from a structured field in the medical record, and they require that the abstractor sees whether the abstractor has to say if a patient is in a clinical trial or not. What the abstractor does, they go through the record and they see if there's no documentation of the patient being in a clinical trial, they will answer no.
Okay.
But they will have to answer no for the measure.
I understand that. So I'm wondering how people are instructed to act differently, or that the definition actually means something very different when you describe an e-measure versus one that's implemented on paper. I completely didn't appreciate that.
So, this is Saheed. Just to add a little bit more to that, I think there are a couple of issues there. One, like in the example Hoot gave about the clinical trials, we have many instances in which the example she gave that they never ever do clinical trials. And so the question is answered, but it is defaulted to no for every case. So in that sense, you can sort of answer the question, but not necessarily have to check every case necessarily. So that's one aspect. The other is that there is something called skip logic within the paper-based measures, so that you don't have to answer every question in every case, so that if you reach a certain point where the rest of the questions are not relevant, you could choose not to answer those questions.
But Hoot said that if you, let's say you do clinical trials on a very, very small number of patients, and you could just choose to take that hit, in other words, your denominator would include folks that are on clinical trials, and so your number would be lower. And that's, so in a sense, unlike the paper, you are no longer truly attesting to the fact that this person on a clinical trial had no mention of them being on one is okay.
So, Paul, in that case, where you have really small numbers, it obviously is going to negatively impact your rate because the case will be in the denominator.
Right.
But it would fail because, the patient was not in trials. So, you know, that's a decision that folks will have to make. Generally speaking, when you have small numbers of cases in the denominator, they are very sensitive to even one or two cases falling out because it would affect your rate a lot. So generally, and not to ignore that.
Paul, I'd add.
And I think that's the problem that we run into when we, if we start trying to say that, you know, people can kind of ignore an exclusion. When you look at where, you know, we're working on core measures and where the, you know, the 50th percentile score is 98%, you can't ignore even small numbers that might fall out. And if we're, as these measures get used more and more for performance programs, people are going to not want to even let go of the possibility of a case or two.
Paul,
just so you know, I think this is a very slippery slope. I'm not saying that providers should be ignoring exclusions, but I do think that there is this belief, and I don't know really how to put it in simple terms. I don't think it's the ignoring the exclusions. It's the other way. So if we specify a measure that makes the space for all of this flexibility so that we have or let's put it another way. Let's say that the clinical trial is very infeasible. We can include it in the measure specs, and everyone's going to be screaming and kicking because we included it and it's not feasible. Yet, if we don't include it, we're already ignoring it at the measure specs level. So it may have different effects on different kinds of providers, and it certainly will, and that will become a problem of its own.
Right. So I wonder if I could just lay out the assumptions that I had before this conversation took place and see where either I was misdirected or whether the field, the community, may share a similar understanding. So I thought a little bit like what you described in the paper world, that you had to fill out all of the data elements, including exclusions, so that you could reliably and accurately report on your numerator and denominator. In a sense, when you fill out paper, you're attesting to all these things as facts. I did not think that there was a different situation in the e-measure from that point of view, and that is one of the reasons why I thought from an NQF point of view, we really did want measure developers to deliberately consider each and every exclusion to make sure that really was material and that the cost outweighed, the benefits outweighed the cost, and do it at that level, i.e. the measure definition level, not have every provider decide whether it's worth them capturing the data elements for exclusions. So this is very new to me, and I want to make sure that I've now understood a new norm that I don't think is widely understood.
Right, and Paul, what I'm not saying that providers should be choosing exclusions to implement or not implement, but there, and I think what you've just described is a very clear distinction between the paper-based world and the e-measure world, and it can be summed in a sentence, which is the paper-based measures make a distinction between data elements that are not touched by an abstractor, so we really don't know the answer to the data element, and we call that missing data. And then there is information that you can't get from the record because you can't determine a date because there's two conflicting dates, let's say. And we call that unable to determine information. From an e-measure perspective, you can't distinguish missing data from failing a criteria. So, for instance, if you are – and that missing data in e-measures includes the unable to determine. So if as an abstractor you can't find information in a record regarding a clinical trial, you will answer no to the data element clinical trial, and that will be considered in the e-measure logic. If you fail to answer that data element, that whole case will be or may be thrown out because the data is missing, and so you can't calculate the measure. From an e-measure perspective, that is no longer the case. So if the data is missing, because you don't have that attestation step, if the data is missing, then you will fail that criterion, and the measure will still be calculated. So there's not a missing data policy around e-measures as there is around paper-based measures. And the kind of missing data policy that we can put around e-measures is going to have to look because there is that attestation step.
This is Riva. I just wanted to note we've got limited time left.
Yeah, do you think that clarification Hoot just made is known by everybody?
Well, Paul, you should know that in a meeting with CMS and ONC, the EHRA raised this issue this week. It was not the first time we raised the issue.
Right.
But apparently both Jim Walker and John Halamka feel that the intention of the policy committee was that measure exclusion should be optional based on the desire of the provider.
Yeah.
This was raised in the meeting that we had with CMS and ONC. I don't think the question was answered definitively, but it was certainly discussed.
So I'm happy to take this offline. I'm amazed. I'm totally caught by surprise on this.
I think you have to make explicit policy about missing data, no matter what. If it's missing EHR or if the provider elects not to enter it, then there has to be some policy about how that's going to look in the measure.
Yeah, and actually, definitely, and this is Helen, I agree. This is a really important issue, and it probably is bigger than specifically the measure feasibility discussion we're having now. But, Karen Pace, our lead methodologist, actually, and I had a conversation with Kevin Larson this week about this exact topic. I mean, we have to have consistency in the way exclusions are done. If they're optional, then you'll wind up with apples, and then you'll wind up with data that cannot have valid comparisons. So I think there's a distinction as well between exceptions and exclusions. I mean, if it's truly an exclusion and it's, it clearly is backed up by evidence, and without it, the results are distorted, it just needs to be there consistently. But I think you've raised an important point, Paul, and others, that we need to come back to.
Yeah, so I'm happy. If there's a way we can arrange this, I do think it impacts feasibility, that's for sure. But
it does.
I'm happy to, participate in some other call that doesn't take this time, but I'd say it's major.
Yeah, Paul. I'll keep you in the loop on the Kevin-Karen conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Zahid. Just for the record, I'll just throw in one more thing, that missing data policy in the abstracted measures is one of the biggest headaches that we have to deal with in terms of how to deal with data that's not there, because it tries to distinguish between missing data versus not being done. It's a huge headache. So the more we can get rid of that, the better it would be.
And this is I just want to make a final comment on this, is that the e-measures really deal with missing data. The way the logic is set up, your criterion is either going to be true or false based on whether the data is in the EHR or not. The way you implement each exclusion and each data element may provide different burden and different accuracy to the data that you're capturing, and I do think that the feasibility framework that we have right now does account for that. So if you have the field there populated often, is it not? And if it's not populated, what does that mean? Does it mean that it isn't reliable, or does it mean that you're only looking for the smoking gun, such as the clinical trial? It's only populated when there is, in fact, that exclusion, for instance.
Yeah.
All right, let's see if we can go get through a few more here.
We've finished all of the comments on the recommendations around the scoring, and the next two on the comments on recommendation 3 and 4 are probably not as high priority. I'd like to skip down to line 46, where we begin the recommendations for recommendation 5, which is around NQF's evaluation for endorsement, because that's something I really want to hear the committee's thoughts on the comments.
Okay. Line 46?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's read that.
I think this first one was one that came up with some of the discussion previously.
Yeah. I think we didn't we come up with new wording for that, Reva?
Yeah, you just want to use multiple systems and no specific installations.
Okay. Let's move on. So number 47. So first of all, should the scorecard be optional or should it be required? Do we state that it's required at this point or not?
It's implied in that the criteria for considering an e-measure would include the results of the e-measure feasibility assessment be included in the measure submission for consideration.
Okay. What do I mean, so the alternative would be, you know, strongly recommend the inclusion and leave it up to NQF to decide whether a submission without the scorecards should be considered.
Well, I'm wondering, would a reasonable response be either use of the scorecard or a summary of a fully transparent equivalent information?
This is, and I think that's a great idea, the equivalence thing. I don't think we want to be too prescriptive because we do want to, we've said multiple times that we want this framework to evolve, and that will only be possible if measure developers are developing either other scorecards or additions to what we have here. So.
Okay. Anybody else want to either agree or disagree with allowing comparable materials as an alternative?
This is Jenny. I agree.
And then, I mean, that does, Reva, so that puts some burden on the NQF to determine whether something is comparable.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, next comment, or actually second part of that comment, there was, we further recommend removing the requirement that measure developers include a plan for improving data elements. Okay. So, page 13. So, I mean, I guess that I kind of agree with the comment. I think the what we wanted, you know, is that you could almost or you could require a comment on the on why it scored a one and you know what might be done. But I don't know that we – do we want to let them off the hook completely and just say, you know, that's kind of beyond the scope of the measure developer?
This is Reva. My question would be is if indeed the developer has identified feasibility concerns with their measure, what's their response to having that problem? Are they going to just ignore it and continue promoting the measure? Are they going to react to it and make some alterations? Are, you know, it's like, what's the explanatory, what's the response?
Yeah.
This is, I agree that the measure developers should, when we are faced with low feasibility score, we need to assess what we're going to do next, whether that is opting for another data element that could be a proxy for what we're trying to capture, modifying what we intended in the beginning to be more feasible, or sticking with what we've had because it's so important and it's a gap in care, for instance, that really should be a data element that is documented and it isn't, for instance. But there should be at least some
yeah.
idea of how the measure developer is going to deal with this. Now, of course, implementing this and incorporating into the workflow is going to be out of the scope for the measure developer, but the recommendation on what to do next and how we're going to deal with it within the scope of the measure, I think it's part of our.
Yeah, so Reva, I think I agree with you. I think that and Root as well, but I think it's this with plans for improving the score, so I think we'd need to reword that a little bit.
So Mike, this is Ahid. I think that's right. That's what I was going to say. That I think that if they come up with you know a data element that scores low, then obviously it's not their sort of in a sense job to improve that score. But I think to the extent that when they have an overall measure feasibility, then it's obviously important if they include that within that, within the framework of the overall e-measure specification, if they are going to include, you know, number one elements, then they need to have a plan of how they want to improve it. But if the at the data element level is determined that it's a number one and they don't want to use it anymore, then it shouldn't be their job to then improve that particular element, right, if I'm reading this correctly? So I think like that clarifies that, you know, at one level it's not their job, but if they include a number one within a specification, then they need to have a plan on how they're going to improve that.
Or even, I would say kind of they have to provide an explanation of, you know, what they're going to do, what they're going to do or not do about the score. But I'll leave it up to Reva to come up with better wording.
If number one elements are included in the specification.
Right. That's
Okay. Next comment is line 48. Isn't this addressed elsewhere in the measure development process? I don't think this is really feasibility as well.
Do we apply anything ruthlessly in our report?
No. But isn't this about, I mean, isn't this kind of measurement in general and not feasibility?
Yes.
I think they may be speaking about to the idea that certain data elements will, if not feasible, will have a greater impact on the measure. And I guess they're making suggestions on what have to be feasible for the measure to be valid. So I think this does go beyond feasibility.
Okay. Then line 49. Okay, I think we already addressed the first part. So the second question about, you know, settings of care and that sort of thing, do we mention that anywhere? I mean, I think it would be worthwhile to add that as an aspirational comment in when we talk about the various numbers of multiple EHR systems, and do we say multiple types of care or not?
No, we weren't that specific.
I think it would depend upon the intent of the measure, though.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and that's why I would keep it pretty broad, but across the types of the various types of locations where a measure would be applicable.
I think we sort of, when we discussed the implementations, we purposely backed off being prescriptive about anything within that. And we just said it preferably should be multiple implementations. Or I'm not even sure if that got in. I know Reva mentioned
we did. That. I think we said we said that. But the other question would be, when we talk about where it was assessed, didn't we say it should, you should capture various metadata about that site, and that would be where this would come in, and I don't know what that exactly that metadata would be, but it would be size of practice and that sort of thing.
Well, I think also there's something about that these people should apply no matter what the care venue that's being assessed.
Right.
Yeah, or across, I would say kind of like across, ideally it would be evaluated at various locations, types of locations.
So I'm curious, this is Futs, I'm curious about the language that NQF currently has for the validity and reliability of measures, regardless of whether they're e-measures or paper-based measures, because it does speak a lot to the sample and what kind of variables should be taken into account. And as far as I can tell, I don't think N2F imposes any kind of sample size and sample characteristics for that piece. So I would guess the same would apply here, and we should be at least as broad as we are for the validity and reliability piece.
Okay. Reva, do you want to, can you add in a little bit of language around across care settings?
Yes, I can.
I mean, and make it a recommendation, not a requirement?
Sure.
Okay. Then I think on number 49, the rest of those we've addressed. We've addressed the number of installations, and then the last one is about minimum of 3 EHR systems seems low. I think we've already addressed that. Although it's unlikely somebody's going to necessarily get a lot more than that, that would be better. But we talked about that. Next one, line 50, American College of Rheumatology appreciates. So let's read that. Yeah, I think that's talking about rewording that comment for a plan for improving the score, and I think we will try to reword that for that first paragraph. The next paragraph. Yeah, and then an extremely high bar, so. So I think we've addressed both of those issues already.
Mike, this is Rita. Because we're talking about NQF's requirements and the guidance for endorsement, there were a couple other things that have come up that I really would like to get the TEP's thought on. One of them is we noticed internally nowhere does NQF require that the measures be submitted in HQMS. Is that a reasonable requirement? Does the TEP agree? Think so? Disagree?
So, Reva, does NQF require HQMF or not?
Right. At this point, we have not explicitly required it.
All right.
The question is, should we?
So, I would look to the measure developers to respond whether that's a reasonable requirement. I mean, if the developers we have on the call feel that it's reasonable, that would be kind of the lowest bar to go over, because I think you also have to think about, you know, non-professional measure developers and whether or not it would hinder them being able to submit an e-measure, which may be all right. But if the professional developers don't feel it's reasonable, we need to know about it.
I had heard, I'm not an expert in HQMF, I had heard there are some required fields in HQMF that may not be relevant to a specific measure, but then, of course, that creates overhead. And actually, I heard this from Epic. Howard, are you familiar with this at all?
Howard, are you still on?
Sorry, my phone was ringing at the same time you asked that. Paul, you'll have to say it again. I'm sorry.
There were some concerns about HQMF, that it had some mandatory fields in it, so that may or may not be relevant to a specific quality measure, and so the mandatory field causes some unnecessary overhead. But I'm not an expert to know that.
Yes, I did hear something like that, but I don't know the details. Actually, on this issue, I would think that we don't need to make a statement about it.
Well, this is a separate question from NQF, though.
Yeah, whether we should require HQMF, whether NQF should require HQMF, and I think it gets into the feasibility issue about can you express a measure in HQMF, and is that basically a minimal feasibility requirement bar to pass?
And as a measure developer, I don't think we're considering right now developing any e-measures that are not represented in HQMF, because it would be I don't even know how we would develop specifications that wouldn't rely on HQMS in the measure authoring tool. But I would also say that this is also a question for implementers. If they're given a measure, an e-measure, that is not an HQMS, what is the barrier to implementation?
Yeah.
And this is Chris. This is part of the whole idea behind, you know, creating e-measures in HQMS is so that the measures themselves are standardized, so that the different implementers and their systems can theoretically be able, if once they can handle HQMS, they can handle any measure that's encoded in HQMS. So I know that that's part of the whole promise behind why HQMS and e-measures were developed in the first place.
Right.
As opposed to using a PDF document to keep representing measures.
Yeah, and this is Jenny.
Actually,
I think that's correct, and I guess I would ask, if it's not in HQMS, how can we be assured of knowing that then when we actually implement that measure and run it through our calculations, that we get an accurate result if we're having to do the interpretation and the formatting ourselves? I would be worried about that.
Exactly.
All right, so it sounds like everybody that's spoken would agree that the HQMS should be required for e-measure submission. Anybody disagree? Okay.
Okay, that's helpful.
Any other questions, Reva? Now we're at the end of our time.
Right. I mean, we need to see if there's anybody on the line for any public comment. I guess the one thing I'm going to ask the committee is the thought that feasibility as an NQF evaluation criterion is not a must pass. And so, again, I think Mike's earlier comment that said it's not a matter of it being a threshold or an infeasible versus feasible, but some kind of high, moderate, and low. And I'm wondering, based on the kinds of things we're expecting people to assess, is there some way we could have a descriptor of what a high rating on feasibility would look like, a moderate rating on feasibility, and a low rating, and then insufficient information? Would that be useful to help address some of those issues?
Reva, I would think that we would need, I mean, it's really, that would be difficult to come up with in a vacuum. I mean, I think we would need some experience with what measures look like and what they score and our experience with the measures to kind of come up with what each one might look like.
Okay. Drawing things out. Okay. Well, since we're at the end, are there any public comment? Is anybody on the line who want to make a comment?
Hi, this is Alyssa Crawford from Mathematica. Can I make a really quick comment?
Sure.
So regarding the last point that you discussed about the use of HQMF, and I don't think we would have any objections to that. I just wanted to note that some things in measure logic can't be documented in HQMF at this point, or can't be documented through the mat specifically, and I'm thinking about composites.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be entered into the mat specifically, and I think there's still some discussion about how to best handle those, but I think it's something that needs to be recognized because some measures may require either some hand modification or some supporting documentation of the specifications to explain things like that. So I don't disagree with the use of HQMF, but I think some measures may need a little more than that to sort of be fully documented.
Thanks. Okay.
Could we say at a minimum HQMF?
Well, this is Hutin. I actually think that's a really good point because if we require HQMF, are we saying that HQMF has everything that we need? And I think that's a really good point that if there are limitations to the HQMF, you may need more than the HQMF.
But you're okay with it being at least that as a minimum. And we can put some language in there around the fact that there may be additional information needed in addition to the HQMF.
Yeah, I mean, you could put in language kind of around an exception policy. I mean, what you want to avoid is people just not doing HQMF because it's hard, as opposed to not doing HQMF because you want to do a composite measure and it doesn't support it.
Right.
Right, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Any other comments from anybody? Public comments particularly? Okay, guys, since we're at the end of our time, we're kind of working on a short timeline to get this out. We want to be able to present it to HITECH and CSAC next week. So the rest of this week, the team and I will be making the revisions to the report that you guys have indicated. We may need to come back at you with some questions by email to clarify things, and we'd appreciate, you know, any responses you're able to provide for us. We will try and get some of these the more major revisions out to you, you know, just in a couple of days to be sure we've captured exactly what you think. But we are trying to get this finalized in the next couple of weeks.
Great. And Rima, can you send that out as a marked up Word document or something so it's easy to find the changes?
Yep, that's what we were planning on.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thanks everybody for your time again, and we'll look forward to hearing from you, Reba.
Okay, we'll do. Thanks, everybody. Really appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.